This is a special all questions answered edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And that means you can call in right away with your personal finance question, whatever it might be. Saving for a child's education, saving for retirement, paying off debt, smart money moves, Kevin's favorite crock pot dish. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he joins us from Wisconsin Public Radio's studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
And this is a special thank you edition of On Your Money. Kevin, what's the plan?
Well, we are going to say thank you to you for listening and for all the pledges that you have sent in during On Your Money by spending the entire hour answering all of the questions that we can fit in, sent in via email at onyourmoney@wpr.org or call 800-642-1234. And if we don't get to it today, we may answer it in a future show.
Yeah. And anything goes, Kevin, even your favorite crock pot recipe?
Oh, hard to pick just one.
We did have a crackpot on Facebook with some deep philosophical question, but all in good fun. Let's start with one from Kathleen. She says, I understand that I must begin with false praise. So here goes. I get up early on Sunday mornings and hang on your every word. That's a good start, Kathleen.
She does it religiously, it sounds like.
I have never heard you address the topic of Kasasa. Did I pronounce that right? Kasasa savings accounts. I have about $10,000 and I would like to grow this money, but I also plan to use it for home improvements, so I want to preserve the principal. There is a bank near me that is offering a Kasasa account and paying 4% on it. And now the true praise. I love your show. Thanks for doing it and thanks to WPR for hosting it. I listened for many years on Tuesdays because I work from home. I live outside your broadcast area and was sad when I had to go to work outside my home and I wasn't able to listen to On Your Money and Garden Talk. So thank you for moving Kevin to Sunday mornings. Well, you're welcome.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Kevin, what do you know about these Kasasa accounts?
It's K-A-S-A-S-A, Kasasa, and you are pronouncing it correctly. Good. And the name is a brand for a process from a company called Bankview. And what the company does is they partner mostly with community banks and credit unions, and they offer technology that allows these smaller institutions to give their customers special terms on the kind of checking and savings account that people normally use for their day-to-day spending and depositing with some restrictions.
How does it work?
What happens is the account does usually pay a higher rate of interest, much higher than what market rates are. That 4% is not unheard of. There are generally no fees for ATM use or for checking accounts or whatever. And there are some other perks. Sometimes the institutions will offer like some special planning tools or spending monitoring things that people can use online. But you do have to use a debit card a certain number of times every single month, or the interest rate paid goes to zero for that particular month. But in most cases, even if you don't use the debit card enough, you still don't incur any fees that you otherwise would have been able to ignore as well.
Is this one of these too good to be true things? Is there a catch?
There's really no catch. The institution ends up making money from the merchants when you use your debit card those 10 or 15 times a month of the minimum that they require. And there is a balance limit on the high yield. Generally, they'll cap the balance on which they pay that high interest rate at maybe $10,000 or $25,000. So if they're capping it at $10,000 and paying you 4%, you earn $400 per year in interest, which is a much more money than you could earn in a traditional checking or savings account. But it's not so much that the institution won't be able to make it back up when you use your debit card so often. And you can find out more about the actual service at kasasa.com, K-A-S-A-S-A.com. And we'll have a link to that up at onyourmoney.com as well. The only thing I didn't like about the service is that on the website, when you say, well, I want to find an institution in my area that offers this particular service, all it does is you type in your city or your town, and then it just takes you to a Google search that tied in the town name and CASASA. So it doesn't take you directly to an institution or even a map in which you can search one. And so it's a little typical, it's a little more difficult to find the service, but you can also check with your institution and see if they offer this service or something like it.
And thanks to Kathleen for the question and for the false praise and the true praise. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. On Your Money is broadcast live on Tuesday mornings, rebroadcast on Tuesday evenings, and rebroadcast on Sunday mornings. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisor prior to making any investment decisions. If you have a question for Kevin during this special all questions answered edition of On Your Money, you can call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And to the phones we go. Raymond in Green Bay is with us. Hello, Raymond.
Well, hello. Thanks for taking my call. My question has to do with required minimum distributions for retired folks who reach 70 and a half in that year. And really, to simplify it, a large chunk of my IRA was invested in a whole life annuity. And I was told at the time that would take care of my RMD. And now, at the penultimate moment, I was called by my financial organization, and they tell me I need to take a required minimum distribution from the remaining money that's in that account, which is now held in stock. So in general, is it true that these annuities don't count towards the RMD, or how can you help me with this?
It's a tricky situation, Raymond, as you no doubt are aware. And it's becoming actually more complicated because there are going to be some kinds of annuities called longevity annuities where the minimum distributions from those will be allowed to qualify for the RMD. Is there an issue of, when you said about selling stock, is there an issue with you don't want to sell it or you can't sell it, or what's preventing you from selling enough stock to actually meet the RMD?
Well, I can sell it. That's not a problem. And it's not that much. But I would rather not. I'd rather leave it there. For the future.
Okay. Yeah, you do have to take the certain amount out, and the amount has to generate. Sometimes, that might be it might be an issue because things aren't liquid or it doesn't push it out, but it sounds like that the annuitization of the contract did not meet what the expected amount would be, and that's a good thing because it probably means that you have more than what the original projection projected that you would have when you reach 70 and a half. So how they do this is they take the balance of all your retirement accounts of the previous year, and then they divide it by an IRS provided factor that's based on your age and your life expectancy, and then you have to take at least that dollar amount out. So it sounds like what happened was the overall balance of the IRA accounts or retirement accounts has grown so much that it actually exceeded what would be provided just from the insurance portion of the account. Does that sound about right?
That sounds like a story, but I can't believe that.
Well, we're in public radio. We're in the business of storytelling.
Yeah, I annuitized about 75% of it. So, and stock hasn't done that well since 2008 when I retired. Although it's done well, not that well. No, they aren't including any calculation for the annuity at all in this calculation for my RMD. They're just including the remaining stock money.
Do you have a CPA with whom you work or a tax preparer?
Well, I do have a tax preparer, not a CPA, though.
Okay. I would encourage you. Here's the deal with the RMDs. Technically, it is on the responsibility of the IRA owner to not only calculate the proper amount, but take at least that dollar amount out. And if you don't do it the right way, the IRS not only makes you still take it out and pay taxes on it, but they hit you with a 50% excise tax on what you should have taken out, meaning If you were supposed to take $10,000 out and didn't, they could penalize you up to $5,000 plus still make you take it out. So here's what I would do. I would take the word of the advisors for what they say, but I would also run it by an actual CPA, pay them the money, and make sure that that you're doing this on the up and up, because it can be very tricky. And even when you're trying to do the right thing, if you don't, you can end up in a lot of trouble.
Good luck, Raymond. Thank you very much for the call. Diana in Western Wisconsin is with us. Hi, Diana.
Good morning. Because I'm such a devotee of On Your Money, I know Kevin is the absolute perfect person to ask this question.
Thank you, Diana.
You're welcome. Thank you. We're looking at opening a home equity line of credit, and we're wondering how having that credit available to us affects our credit score. And secondly, if you have any of your magic formulas for determining how large that should be, the line of credit, maybe in relation to our income, or we're looking at it as a little safety net for the next 5 to 10 years. Okay. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you for taking my call. Bye-bye.
Sure. Well, I will give my answer off the air.
Please give it on the air, sir.
Oh,
for the rest
okay.
Of us.
I'm sorry. The credit score. First of all, it's not going to be a big deal to have a home equity line of credit on it. If it does affect it, it probably will affect it most when you actually apply for it, because there'll be a hard inquiry on your credit report. After that point, then what does matter more is your payment history. If you're making payments on it and making them on time, it not only won't hurt your credit score, but it will probably help it a little bit. And then in terms of the rules of thumb, was it rules of thumb on how much they were supposed to ask for?
If you had a magic formula that would help them in deciding how much of a line of credit they should open up.
Right. My magic formula is when they say, how much do you want? You say, how much can I get? That's my magic formula. And, the only reason I wouldn't take more is if there were some significant fees at some threshold. Say if they said, well, we'll give you $25,000, and then there's no annual fee, and then there's no appraisal fee or anything, or no application fee. And then anything over that, we're going to charge you all those different fees. That's the only thing that would limit how much I would ask for. The other thing that might limit, if you are self-aware enough to know that if you have access to all that credit, that you will borrow against it for reasons you wish you hadn't, that's one more reason to keep a cap on it.
Thanks very much, Diana, for your call. We'll take more of your questions for Kevin McKinley in just a moment. 1-800-642-1234, or send your email with your personal finance question to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is a special all questions answered edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and this is the Ideas Network.
I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. Hey, hey. Well, I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. Thanking you for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio all year long and your support of On Your Money. This is a special thank you, a special all questions answered edition of On Your Money. And our next caller is Faye in Milwaukee. Hello, Faye.
Hello. My question is, I'm just trying to make sure I get on the right phone here. Okay. I worked for a company for 30 years and was an employee, and they quit business, and now I don't have health insurance anymore, and so I have to, as an independent contractor, I will have to pay for my own health insurance. Is there any type of a plan for an independent contractor to take this money out of pre-tax income?
I'm sorry, you mean use money from an IRA or a 401k to pay for it?
I mean, with my other company, they would just, all of my health insurance was taken from pre-tax income through a flex plan, I think
right.
That's what it was called. Is there something that I could do as an independent contractor the same way?
Generally, No, not in the sense that that you can pull it out tax free. You can open up an HSA, a health savings account. Are you familiar with those, Faye?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's probably the most apt way to do it. You can also open up an FSA if you can find someone who's willing to offer it to you. But generally, those come only through employers. But the HSA is probably the better way to go about it. Again, as long as you can find it. The nice thing about HSAs versus FSAs is that the FSA, the flexible spending account, those are usually a use it or lose it proposition to a great degree. Meaning, if you don't exhaust it within a typical year, you don't get to keep the money. The HSA, the health savings account, allows you to roll it over and accumulate any unused or unspent balance for it. So that's actually a preferable way to go. And unless you have some things that don't qualify for the HSA, which would have qualified for purchase under the FSA, the HSA is a better, more amenable way to go.
Thank you, Faye. Good luck. Matt in Sparta is with us now. Hello, Matt.
Hi there. So currently I'm a full-time student living pretty frugally. I'm going to school to be a physician's assistant, so hypothetically when I get a PA job, I'll be making a decent salary, and my plan is for the first couple of years to put the majority of that into savings. And my question is, what's the priority for putting away, you know, decent sums of money? I know there's limits to how much you can put in to certain accounts per year, and other than employee matching for like an IRA or something, what would be the next couple steps in the priority list?
Congratulations on your prospective employment, Matt, and I'm glad you're thinking positively about this. Here's how I would go with any earnings that you get from that employment or for people who are fortunate enough to already have extra earnings from employment. I would first want to make sure that you had at least 6 to 12 months of living expenses set aside, and that should be in a fairly liquid account like a checking or savings account, perhaps a Roth IRA, which we'll get to. But 6 to 12 months of living expenses protects you against any hiccups in your employment and any emergencies affecting your financial future. But also, it forces you to actually examine what you're spending every single month so that you can figure out what 6 to 12 months of that number is. Second thing I would do is make sure that you're contributing enough to your pre-tax retirement plan, at least to get any employer match, as you mentioned, Matt, and then also to get your taxable income down to the 15% federal level, if you possibly can. That number is delineated on line 43 of your 1040, and for single filers, it's $36,900 on line 43 for 2014, and twice that amount for married couples filing jointly. And once you get to that amount, if you have any money left over, then I would put money into that Roth IRA. And again, the great thing about the Roth IRA is you can pull the money out at any time for any reason with no taxes or penalties whatsoever, the contribution portion. So that serves as kind of an ERSAT savings account for you. And then if you have anything left over, keep putting that up in a savings account for future purchases, travel, trips, or whatever, or when you need a break from your stressful job as a physician's assistant.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Matt. Thanks for the call. Beth in Jefferson County is our next caller. Hi, Beth. What's your question?
Hi, Kevin and Joy. Thank you for making money managing somewhat entertaining and
successful. I will accept somewhat. I will take. I am not insulted by the low expectations. All right. So, yes.
I have some money that I divested from some stocks because I've decided that the next step after protesting is divesting, and ultimately I want to get into investing. But for right now, the timing is kind of interesting because I have a daughter about to enter college, and I'm going to have to start filling out these FAFSA forms. And I want to put the money somewhere where they don't decide, oh, you've got all that money sitting in an account, I guess as a parent, then your contribution is going to go way up because you've got cash sitting there. I'm wondering, is there any smart way for me to, where should I put that money so that it isn't just ended up being tuitioned?
Okay. Well,
I have a fairly moderate income.
Okay.
So normally we get a good amount of aid.
The good news is that parental assets are generally a very small portion of what they call the expected family contribution. And have you gone to any of the websites, Beth, that tell you, you know, put in your numbers here and we'll tell you kind of what you can expect to pay yet?
Have I done that?
Yes.
No, I haven't.
Okay. There's one at finaid.org, finaid.org. I think is the one, and if you Google expected family contribution calculator, you'll find some other ones as well, and we'll put some up at onyourmoney.com after the show too. So that's one way, and you will find out, especially if your income is fairly moderate or modest, you will find out that they really don't expect a whole lot. That's the good news. The bad news is that any financial aid that does come to people, especially these days and at the schools at which most students attend, it comes in the form of loans, not in terms of just free grants and scholarships that come raining down from above. So unless there's some exceptional situation with the school or with your daughter, who I'm sure is gifted and talented, there isn't going to be a lot of free money just from hiding this. Now, that said, if you said, well, I want to do something so it doesn't show up as much, one thing you can do is you can put some of the money into any retirement plan savings vehicle that you have, which is not only a good idea for the financial aid formula, but it's also a good idea to save for retirement instead of pay the money for college, because you can borrow money to go to college, but you cannot borrow money to retire.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Beth. This is a special all questions answered edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. Kevin is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC with offices in Madison and Eau Claire. And this is, as I mentioned, an all questions answered edition of On Your Money. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And here's an email from a listener named Cole, who says, "Hey, I have been listening to your shows since before you had a regular spot with Joy. I adore your advice, more or less, even though I never follow it." All right, cool. "I was wondering, as a fiscal pariah, is there any hope for me? I have been around $15,000 in student debt besides a couple thousand in personal credit card debt. Quite frankly, I understand I could never get anything besides a secured credit card at this point, but I guess I wonder about all the long-term effects of my debt. I wish I was taught about credit because I didn't know anything until I realized I had violated some rules and I had a terrible credit rating." Aw, so Kevin, is he in as bad a shape as he thinks?
No, he's being too hard on himself, and he is no pariah whatsoever. 70% of college graduates in 2014 had some form of student loans, and the average balance of those amounts was $33,000. So $15,000 of student loans is nothing. And the average credit card balance for people who have credit cards is about $15,000 right now. So a couple thousand dollars is nothing. The average credit score is about 700 to 720, depending on the score and the person in question here. So I'm not sure what Cole's score is. Probably not quite at that level, but at least in his debt levels, he's much better than the average balances.
So what can he do to improve his situation?
He should actually get that secured credit card. That is a very good step for people who have credit that is not as well thought of as they would like it, is to get that secured credit card. What that is you put $500, let's say, in an account, assuming you have $500, and then you charge against that $500. And as you demonstrate that you can do this and keep replenishing the account, et cetera, over time, your credit score goes up enough that you can hopefully get an unsecured card, one where they're willing to trust you enough to lend you the money to and give you the credit limit. He may also want to consider trying to take some extra measures to pay down his debt. He can do it very slowly. If he gets an extra job or something and makes $10 an hour times, you know, 10 hours a week or something, yeah, it's going to take him 3 years to pay off that balance just from that income, but it won't take nearly that long for him to see some kind of increase in his credit score.
So what do you think of his concern over the lack of education about debt and credit?
Well, I agree with it. I don't, you know, I don't blame the schools because, quite frankly, they don't have enough time in the day as it is, although Wisconsin is a leader in fostering financial literacy among its students and its populace. And most of that is due to us, but no, it's something that the Department of Public Instruction has put together and made a concerned effort with the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions to increase financial literacy in its citizens. But the problem is that there's such an overwhelming tide of money from the lending companies, both student loans, credit cards, et cetera, who are trying to get at these people, not just to make money off them, but to get them in their customer pipeline to try to make them customers and borrowers for life. And adulthood is really a term that is difficult to measure except in numbers and age. And many times those of us who are 18 or 21 or 25 or 55 make mistakes with money that can really come back to haunt us. And so one of the good lessons that Cole provided by asking this question is if you think your credit is not what it should be, you need to fix it now, because when you actually need good credit, it takes a long time to fix it. And so you should start working on it right now rather than just say, oh, well, I'm not borrowing any money, what do I care?
So thank you, Cole, for the kind words, for the question, and follow Kevin's advice, and you will be just fine.
Remove your pariah status.
That's right. Linda in La Crosse is with us now. Hi, Linda.
Hi there.
Yes, what's your question?
Thanks for taking the call. Love the program. I have IRA mutual funds that have been underperforming. I'd like to sell them and buy some other ones. But, of course, if I'm selling high, then I'm also, if I do it, you know, right then and there, I'm also buying low generally when the market is down. Mm-hmm. So is it better to sell some and put them in holding someplace before I buy some other ones when the market is better?
Hmm. By better, do you mean higher or lower?
Well, I want to sell high and buy low. I mean, excuse me. I want to sell high, buy low. So mm-hmm. if I'm doing it on the same day, if the market generally is down, mm-hmm. I'm selling ones that, so getting a good price on my sell, but then the market being down high, I'm also buying high.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? No, I'm just kidding. It is actually is confusing. And what you're saying is you say you want to get out of one fund into the other. But you're concerned that if you sell one fund today and then buy the other one, that if things go up a lot, you'll have missed out on the other one. You don't know how to make the transition quickly for it, right?
That's true. I want to do it quickly, and I want to do it without... I don't want to buy high.
Right. You probably have to, two things have to happen for you to sell high and buy low. One is you have to, first of all, sell it at a time when prices are high. Second of all, asset prices have to drop of whatever it is that you're considering purchasing. And the third thing is you have to pull the trigger on the purchase at a time when it is lower. And so it's very difficult to make all those things line up perfectly and then have the gumption after prices have dropped to start buying. I'd go back up a little bit here. Do you know why, or have you analyzed why you feel that the funds and stocks, et cetera, have, to use your words, underperformed?
Do I know why? No, other than they have.
I would rather have you look at that first and see why have they underperformed. Were these ones you purchased for yourself, or did you buy them with the help of an advisor?
Many, many years ago with an advisor.
Okay. You may want to talk to either that same advisor or go find another one and say, are these good funds? And if so, should I keep them? Because sometimes funds underperform because they're not very good funds. Other times they underperform, especially during good times, because they're maybe more conservative than the more aggressive funds or the indices that, like the S&P 500 or the Dow Jones Industrial Average, that you might be weighing their performance against. So I would be cautious about just jumping out of those and into something else, especially at a time when you mentioned, Linda, and I agree with this. We're probably closer to the high in the United States stock market anyway than we are to the low. And so by buying that new fund, you may be jumping out of the frying pan and into the fire.
Yeah. Good luck, Linda. Thank you for the call. Roger in Milwaukee is with us now. Hello, Roger. Roger, we are you at the phone?
Hello?
Yes,
hello?
Roger, go ahead. What's your question?
Oh, I have a question. I've just recently retired. So right now I'm starting to get my pension and Social Security, but I have some money sitting in like Fidelity and TIA crap that I've put in over the years. And, I mean, I don't really need it right now. I'm not sure what I should do with it. It's mostly, I think, all stocks. Do I want to, like, move some of it into index funds, or can I do something with it to just make sure, I don't want to lose my money. I don't know, am I a little bit too risky or not having most of my money in stocks? Or
it could be. Are you getting enough to cover your basic living expenses, Roger, from your pension and Social Security?
Yeah, really, the two of them put me at the same level as when I was working, maybe even actually a little more take-home. So I'm really at about the same level as when I was actually working.
Okay.
I don't know if there's some way I can just use the interest off these then maybe to do some I'd like to do some traveling and stuff, and I suppose that at some point then right there's like you're talking about this minimum distribution right now. I'm about 66, so I have a few more years.
Okay. Well, you can take money out of those retirement accounts to travel or to pay for anything else. And as a rule of thumb, what you probably want to do, Roger, is divide whatever the balance is of those liquid accounts. That can be your IRAs, Roth IRAs, checking, savings, etc. And divide that amount by, say, 200. And that is a good rule of thumb for what you could spend in a particular month without worrying about exhausting the money sooner than you are exhausted. So let's say you have $100,000. You might divide that figure by 200, and that'll give you $500 per month that you could budget or save for extra things like travel above and beyond your basic living expenses. And I would also check with the people at TIA, CREF, and Fidelity and say, hey, here's my situation. What advice can you give me on these different accounts? You know, you're paying fees to keep the money at those places, whether you know it or not. So you might as well use their services up and just get their thoughts on it. And then finally, one thing I would also do, Roger, is if you're not interested in losing money, the money should not be in stock mutual funds, because those can and definitely will go down in value at some point. If you're okay with that risk, then it's okay to keep them there. But otherwise, you might want to look at putting at least some of that money, and maybe all of it, into CDs that aren't going to pay you very much interest, 1%, 2% maybe, but they are going to be there when you need it. More importantly, they're not going to go down in value if the other investments go down in value, giving you a chance to not only preserve your spending power, but maybe reinvest it at lower prices in the future.
Good luck, Roger. Thanks for the call. We'll take more of your calls with your personal finance questions for Kevin McKinley in just a moment. 1-800-642-1234 is our number. You can also email us onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is a special all questions answered edition of On Your Money here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is an all-questions-answered edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. With us each week at this time with information and advice on your money. And today we are spending the entire hour answering your calls and your emails. It's a thank you for your support all year long of On Your Money. Here's an email from Peter in Portland. Wow, that's kind of neat. Somebody in Portland. Hello, Kevin and Joy. I've been listening to On Your Money for about 7 years, first in real time while I lived in Wisconsin, and now via podcast since I moved to Oregon. Love it. That's nice. I'm 29. I have a family of four. We are looking to buy a house. We have about 17% of the down payment saved in a savings account, which is also our emergency fund. I'm wondering if it would be worth liquidating some of our assets that we are in, a Roth IRA, to get us to the 20% down payment to avoid paying the PMI. Is that a good approach, Kevin?
Well, back up for a second. I wonder if the advent of the internet and, as a subset, podcasting has allowed people to move out of Wisconsin who otherwise would have had to stay in the state just so they could hear Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yeah, that's right. We don't want that.
Could be a huge factor here. Yeah, Peter, you could You could liquidate the accounts, but I would say that's a mistake. Lenders usually require a 20% down payment, but not always, so that they can have that amount of equity in the house to give you the loan. And it's also kind of a backhanded measure of your ability to purchase, meaning the lender figures if you can't come up with 20% to purchase the home for and use it as a down payment, how are you going to be able to get through on a month-to-month basis for it? If you still don't have that much, the 20% amount, you can still purchase the house, but in many cases, you'll be forced to buy private mortgage insurance called PMI. And you, what you're really doing is you are paying for the risk that the lender is taking by lending you the money. You're purchasing the insurance policy that makes it more likely that the lender will be made whole if you can't make your mortgage payment and they can't sell the house for enough to cover the balance owed. The cost of PMI is usually about a half to 1% of the mortgage balance. So on a $200,000 mortgage, for example, you might end up paying $1,000 to $2,000 per year just in PMI expenses.
Oh, that seems kind of pricey.
In this case, it is, but I'd say that in Peter's case, it's probably worth it. It allows him to use any money that is remaining to move, and moving does cost money. It always costs more than you expect. If there are any improvements in the new home that need to be made immediately, just to make it livable, I'm not talking about, you know, ripping up the carpeting in the basement, but sometimes there are things that are so wrong with the place that you just have to get it fixed right away. Or, and this is where it really comes in handy, it might need to be made make a mortgage payment down the road. Peter and his family could just get in trouble and not have enough savings set aside. And having that extra money there, even though it's going to cost them a little bit more per month to pay the PMI, the extra money will allow them to make the mortgage payment, and then they get 30 new days to figure out not only how to cover their other expenses, but where that next mortgage payment is going to come from.
How will Peter eventually get out of paying this private mortgage insurance?
I'll take care of it. It's a nice question. He sounds like a good guy. His head's in the right place. Now, once the equity in the home reaches 20% of the value, meaning what if it's a, let's just say it's a $200,000 house, once the equity equals $40,000, it might be through appreciation in the home, it might be some pay down of the mortgage, although one of the things that homeowners are always dejected by is when they get that first or second or third mortgage schedule and they see how little those big mortgage payments are actually paring down that mortgage debt. Once he gets to that point, he probably will have to write a letter to the lender saying, I would like that PMI removed, here's why, et cetera. That might require an appraisal so he can prove to the lender that it really is, at least he really does have 20% equity in it. And the lender might also require that even if he does exceed the 20% standard, they may require that that PMI has to be in place for a certain period of time. So definitely check on all the restrictions of that before you proceed.
And thanks for the email, Peter from Portland. If you're in-state or out-of-state, you can email us onyourmoney@wpr.org, or you can call 1-800-642-1234. And looky here, we have another out-of-stater, David in Ormond Beach, Florida. Well, hello.
Good morning, Joy, and good morning, Kevin. And I didn't move away because I wanted to. My wife got a job down here 12 years ago, but I hope to come back to Wisconsin soon.
Good. Well, I don't feel quite so spurned since you did it out of love, so good for you.
Well, once the cheesehead, always the cheesehead, right?
Right on.
My question, I don't suffer from this problem because it has to do with lottery winnings. I've been curious for a long time. You hear about these people that win multi-millions, you know, $80, $90 million in a lottery. What do you do with that money? Where do you put it? I mean, you can't have a stack of bank books a foot high because they only cover $100,000, in loss as far as savings accounts goes. But what do these people do? Say you win $80 million.
Mm-hmm. Most of them actually just donate whatever they don't need to Wisconsin Public
That's
Radio.
Right,
and they get a tote bag for it. It's a really nice setup. Now, what they usually do is they hire a financial advisor or a team of advisors, including a CPA, an attorney, and they scatter it all around in places and try to invest it in a way that it'll generate enough income. And what happens more often than not, at least relative to the general population, is they lose it. And some of that is because it seems like more money than it actually is, and so they spend more than they can. Some of it is also the demographic of the people who regularly buy lottery tickets are the ones who are most likely to win. And those people have just had trouble managing money in the past, and it doesn't change just because they get a bunch of it. So sometimes there are ways that you can keep it FDIC insured. By buying very large jumbo CDs, and then they spread the risk out by using other types of banks so that it remains with the limit. And by the way, it's not $100,000. It's been bumped up to $250,000 or so. But now, usually it's a good problem to have, but they have a new job, and that new job is now managing that newfound wealth.
Yeah, well, I'd like to have to deal with that problem for once in my life. That'd be kind of fun.
You can't win if you don't play.
David, thank you very much. Enjoy the beach. Let's go to Mai in Appleton. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My question is that we have a timeshare 10 years ago, and it seemed like maintenance fee continued to rise. But the problem is we rarely use it, and we try to get out of it. But people tend to say, you can't get out. And I call the timeshare people, and They don't want you to get out. So my question is, in any way that Kevin know how we can get out of the timeshare?
Again, since I'm in the giving mood, I'll take it off your hands. Just give me your price, Maya, and I'll buy it for you. Is it in a nice place?
Say again?
Is it in a nice place? Where is the timeshare located?
Yes, it's with the Worldwide Wyndham Resort.
So you can use it in lots of different locations, right?
Yes.
Okay, and you've already approached the company who sold you the timeshare in the first place, correct?
Yeah, we asked them if we can, we just want to get rid of it. And they say they don't have that program, and they say that they will look into it, and they will let us know. And I also tried to give away, but people tend to back down because of the maintenance fee.
That's right. And that's usually what happens with people. And I actually know several savvy people who have purchased timeshares and actually very happy with them. One, because it forces them to go on a vacation just because they don't want to use that or lose that money that they paid for the place. But in terms of trying to get rid of it, you can do it. It's a question of finding the price at which some other person is willing to pay for it. So you can expect to lose money on the purchase, in part because there are a lot more of these available for sale than there are people wanting to buy them. And the second thing about it is that if you do sell it, the good news is if you do lose money, you're still going to be out from under those maintenance fees going forward. And the longer you don't sell it, of course, the longer you pay those fees that would have more than made up the difference for it. I would advertise it on a place like Craigslist or eBay or something, but be very careful about selling this via those routes, because a lot of times unscrupulous people will contact you and say, hey, I see you're trying to sell your timeshare. I'll actually sell it for you. Pay me an upfront fee and I'll get rid of it for you, or give me the listing rights to sell it. And you usually don't want to do that. So the good news is you can sell it. The bad news is you're probably going to take a pretty big loss on it. So don't expect to get your money back on it. And let this be a lesson to those of you who are considering a purchase of a timeshare in the future.
I'm sorry about that, and good luck. Next, we go to Corey in Watertown. Hello, Corey.
Morning, Joy. Good morning, Kevin. I've got a real pretty simple question for you. I usually file my taxes each year on with electronic filing for both state and federal. And this year, for one reason or another, I didn't get around to it. So now it's November, and I'm wondering what I do.
Oh, well, the good news is the IRS and the state will be more than happy to hear you and get your taxes for you. You probably have to. Did you owe any money, do you know, Corey?
No, they owe me. They always do.
Oh, well, then they're going to be very happy about that. I would just file the form. And do you usually do it yourself, or do you have a professional who helps you prepare it?
I usually do it myself. You know, I use like a Tax Act or whatever, electronic filing program online. But
okay.
You can't do that. Once you get past a certain time, those programs don't let you do it.
No, you're right.
You have to get paper forms.
Yep, I would just contact the IRS and just tell them your story. I guarantee you will not be the first person who has contacted them today and says, then they're actually going to be happy to hear from you at first, and then they'll be disappointed after they find out that they owe you money. But, yeah, you might have to pay a little bit in some penalties for it, too. But, no, you definitely want to file, and especially when – when they owe you money.
They should have to pay me in penalties because they owe me money.
Yeah, I wish it worked that way, but no, it doesn't.
All right. Good luck, Corey. We have Arlene in Clintonville with us now. Hello, Arlene.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a real quick question for you, too, Kevin, that I believe you don't have to take RMDs out of Roth IRAs. Is that right?
That is correct, as long as it is your IRA and you are still alive. Are you still alive at this moment, Arlene?
Slightly.
Okay, good. That's good enough for me. Then no, you do not have to take RMDs from Roth IRAs.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's go to another caller. Thanks, Arlene. Ted in Woodruff. Hello, Ted.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call, and enjoy your show. It's both educational and fun.
Thank you.
We try to get one out of two, so two out of two is great. Thank you very much,
yeah.
Tim.
Situation. My wife and I are in our early 40s. We have two children, 8 and 5. And the question deals with secondary beneficiaries on our term life insurance and on our retirement funds. We list each other, my spouse and I, as the primary beneficiaries. But if we both die, if we list our children as the secondary beneficiaries, they're too young to really manage the money and deal with that. Is there a better idea for the secondary beneficiaries?
No, you still, some people do this and try to conquer this problem, Ted, by leaving it to a trusted family member. And you can do that, but man, that has to be a really trusted family member because if you do that for the right person, it's almost a burden to them by leaving them the money and say, hey, you're an adult, we trust you, spend it appropriately for our kids. A better way to do it is to visit a lawyer and to set up an empty trust and make that empty trust the beneficiary of the life insurance and then have the kids be the beneficiaries of that trust. And then hopefully what will happen is if in the highly unlikely in an event that something happens to you and your wife, the money will go into the trust, not directly to the kids. And then the lawyer will help you draft the trust with language that says, hey, these kids only get certain amounts of money at certain ages, like a third when they're 21, a third when they're 25, and the rest when they're 35 or something, or they can only pull it out to pay for college or to buy a house, or they only get it when they get married, or whatever you want to put in there really is your choice. And then if the unfortunate and unthinkable happens, you will then have the trust in place to get the money, and hopefully the court will appoint a trustee to oversee that trust and oversee the money, and then also make sure that it is used only as you intended.
All right, Ted, good luck to you. Here's a quick one from Dennis. Which is better to use for small purposes, say $25 or less, a credit card or a debit card?
Actually, if you're interested in protecting your information, debit cards are very good, but the credit card still offers more protection for it. The only reason that I would say that you shouldn't use a credit card or debit card for those smaller purchases, that there are often flat fees that are charged to the merchant, and you often see that plastic only for purchases of above so much. And the reason being is because if there's a flat fee charged to the merchant, then they actually lose money on the sale. So I'd prefer you to use the credit card as long as you know you're going to pay it off.
All right. Good luck, Dennis. Finally, the website of the week in less than a minute, Kevin.
Pat from Wausau is a regular listener who asks, what's the best free or inexpensive way to check credit scores? So we have a cornucopia of sites to use regarding your credit. Start at creditkarma.com. That's free. It's an ad-supported site that gives you an estimate of your credit score. MyFICO.com gives you your actual FICO score, but it does cost between $20 to $60, depending on how many bureau scores you choose to obtain. AnnualCreditReport.com gives you one free credit report per bureau per year, and you can freeze your report by going to tinyurl.com/cfreeze.
Great. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.